Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. President-elect Donald Trump no longer wants to move forward with an investigation into his former Democratic rival, Hillary Clinton. A spokesperson for Trump told MSNBC today that by doing so, Trump is setting a tone for Republicans in Congress. Well, we've been checking in with members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation for their thoughts after the divisive presidential election. Today, we're joined by Democratic Congressman Richard Neal. He's dean of the delegation. He represents Massachusetts' first congressional district, which covers parts of western Massachusetts. Congressman Neal, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be with you, Deb.
So first off, let's get your reaction to today's news that President-elect Trump does not want to move forward with an investigation of Hillary Clinton, something that he promised during the election. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm pleased that the Trump administration has acknowledged that we don't live in a third world country where all of a sudden the victor in the campaign then decides to have the loser in the campaign imprisoned. And I thought that was another very bad moment during the course of the campaign, and I think it came on the heels of the chants that said, lock her up. Mm-hmm. And I must tell you, I think that in one sense, we're all relieved that this campaign is over, and I think that it did not lift our aspirations, that's for sure.
So overall, talk to me a little bit about what you're thinking now that this campaign is over and the election is over.
Well, Deb, one of the things that comes to mind immediately is that these campaigns go on too long. I think there's broad agreement. It drives the money chase and it drives the advertising chase, and it also builds more conflict into the system. And I think that the candidates then, after they've said things, for example, as you've described it, then all of a sudden announce 2 weeks after the campaign, well, that was never really on the agenda anyway. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a troubling aspect when you consider that a campaign should be about forming a government and that there is a connection to the electioneering process. But part of it is, I think, to inspire people. And in this instance here, I think that we leave this campaign season without a lot of inspiration, that's for sure.
Well, I think Mr. Trump may have inspired a lot of people, obviously. There are a significant number of people who supported him, and they think that he's going to bring change.
Well, when you consider that half the American people, 46%, really didn't show up on Election Day, that's another consideration. And I think that one could pursue that argument by simply saying, well, in the state of Wisconsin, which Secretary Clinton lost by 27,000 votes, that the turnout in Milwaukee was down by 40,000 votes. So I have concluded that in a couple of the big states that the polling was within a margin of error, so I think there's some forgiveness that's granted there. But not to miss the point that these campaigns are so poisonous now at virtually every level. And then we ask the public to rally to us in terms of governance afterwards, and it becomes much more challenging.
But also, I just want to go back to the point, though, that some people were, in fact, inspired by Donald Trump and supported him. You know, many in your district. You know, although the state of Massachusetts ultimately supported Hillary Clinton in the election, it was, I think, 60-33%. We looked at some of the numbers in your district, and the vote was about 57% Clinton, 37% Trump. Now, still, obviously, way ahead for Hillary Clinton. But 37% for Donald Trump. And also, the top five communities in Massachusetts that favored Trump over Clinton are in your district. So what do those results say to you?
Which you can also contrast it with the fact that on the same day, 75% of those voters voted for me. And I think that that's fairly telling as well. I don't want to understate the role that the protest vote played in this campaign, because I think that would be a great disservice to the energy on the other side. But I also think that one of the things that happened during the course of this campaign was that there were a series of outrageous statements that were offered. And then if we simply say, well, I really didn't mean it, and I've been going through polling data, for example, that where many people that supported Donald Trump are now saying, well, they never believed that he was really going to build the wall and ask the Mexican government to pay for it.
Right.
And so I think that there is a series, that there's a certain degree of license that one gets in a campaign. Don't get me wrong. But there's also a moment, I think, to talk about the future and to talk about some of the concrete things that one would do if they were to accede to the highest office in the land. And I think that in this instance, there were three debates. The issue of global warming never came up. There were three debates. The issue of real infrastructure investment really never came up. the worker participation rate in America, which is now at a post-war low, never came up. And for the first time in 30 years, productivity is not going to grow. That never came up. And I think that economic anxiety that was coursing through the system, and you'll hear my colleagues in the delegation, they would tell you that I talk about this stuff all of the time. And instead, we were talking about nasty woman and that we're going to impanel a special grand jury afterwards, and we're going to have a special prosecutor. I just think that democracy pays a price for that in a representative arena.
Let's talk about Trump's transition team so far. He's proposed several appointments. Your thoughts in general. Can you make a general thought about some of his appointments?
I think that there is a certain degree of latitude that a president-elect is granted. I mean, he did win the election, so I think that there will be ample time through the hearing process and the vetting process when questions will be asked and there will be an opportunity for those who require congressional consent to state their views in public. But I would go so far as to be critical of Steve Bannon's appointment because I think he has flirted with intense racial statements and anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the quest for public office, we sometimes surround ourselves with people that we bring to government afterwards. And I think the test case ought to be that they avoid those sort of charged moments as Bannon did during the campaign.
Let's talk about potential appointments because we have a Massachusetts connection here. Former Senator Scott Brown, who apparently is being considered to head Veterans Affairs. He met with Trump yesterday. What do you think about Senator
Brown? I think he's a worthy candidate to quote Governor Baker. I think that he has a military record. I think that he served in the U.S. Senate. And I think that in this instance here, that if the vetting process doesn't come up with any questions, I would think that he'd be a fine candidate.
Another member of the Massachusetts delegation, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, one of her key issues recently has been promising to fight to keep the current structure of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's the agency she helped create 6 years ago. But a federal court recently ruled that the agency's structure is unconstitutional, and that kind of opens the way for all kinds of changes, which, of course, are uncertain under the new administration. What are your thoughts?
Well, I certainly support the Consumer Board, but I think you're very perceptive in the critique that you've just offered. And that is the argument against it, as I hear it and see it, it's really as to whether or not the executive can unilaterally transfer executive authority to an individual in an appointed capacity as opposed to an elected capacity that would have these sort of broad powers and not have to answer to congressional oversight. So I think that's really the issue. But at the same time, I think in the aftermath of what came out of the worst recession since the Great Depression, I think Senator Warren is correct on that issue. We need to maintain a Consumer Protection Board and have somebody serve as an overseer within the constitutional framework of responsibility.
You know, because of where you sit on congressional committees, there are some issues over which you're going to have direct involvement, issues that came up during the campaign and presumably will be part of the early days of the Trump administration, taxes and trade, right?
And infrastructure, because you have to figure out how to pay for it.
Right. And, of course, we talked about infrastructure yesterday. We've got a lot of criticism about President-elect Trump's position on infrastructure today. We don't have a lot of specifics on these on some of these proposals, but we do know, for instance, when it comes to taxes, that Trump has suggested things such as eliminating the estate tax and cutting taxes on the middle class. He's also suggested renegotiating NAFTA and getting out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, let's unpack those two issues a bit. Let's start with taxes. What do you think about what you know of President-elect Trump's tax plan?
Well, it strikes me as though I was reading the New York Times this morning, and Arthur Laffer was cheering for it on the front page of the Times. And I think that it takes us back to Jack Kemp's years of making the argument for what are called supply-side economics during the Reagan years. And the problem with the argument is that they have said for decades that tax cuts pay for themselves. And, Deb, there's really no evidence that supports that position. You really can't find a mainstream economist who would embrace that position as well. So let me just give you a quick synopsis of where I think that the parallel is. On January 20th of 2001, when George W. Bush took the oath, he was looking at a projected surplus from CBO of almost $5 trillion over 15 years. And granted, it's a projection. And we cut taxes by 2001 by $1.3 trillion. And we came back in 2003 and cut taxes by another trillion. So we had $2.3 trillion worth of tax cuts during the Bush years, and we fought two wars, and the deficits exploded. And I think that whether one is a supporter of President Reagan or not, you do have to come to the conclusion that while we doubled military spending in those years, and I was in Congress just as the president was leaving, that we doubled military spending and cut taxes. And I think that those are the kinds of issues that then get us into the soup in terms of long-term deficits and debt. So Clinton leaves four successive balanced budgets. And if you recall, Alan Greenspan was warning us against paying down the debt too quickly. Mm. So the clock in Times Square that used to chronicle the debt, that had been turned off. So I have this memory institutionally because I've been on the Ways and Means Committee for a long period of time. And I recall vividly these arguments as they played out. And the inducement to the tax cuts during the Bush years was supposed to be economic growth. It is, I think, clear to say that it was the slowest economic growth since Herbert Hoover was president. And I don't say this to you to sound as though I'm whiny, because I do think that you could perhaps consider some targeted middle-class tax cuts. Because the economy, regardless of what both sides say on this, it's really been representative of pretty slow growth. 1.8% to 2.0%. That does not create enough jobs to really break through the deficits.
Okay.
And recall that deficits are mounted as you have tax cuts, and then the recession adds to it because social spending is formulaic.
Okay, so I think we're going to be debating this for quite some time. Essentially, what you're saying is we haven't really learned from history here when it comes to taxes and economic growth, and things might need to be rethought a little bit, and I'm sure we'll be able to talk about that another day. Is that okay, Congressman?
I'd be delighted to.
Okay, Congressman Richard Neal,
happy
Dean.
Happy Thanksgiving to you and all.
Oh, happy Thanksgiving
all
to you
best.
As well. Congressman Richard Neal, Dean of the Massachusetts Congressional Delegation, represents the state's first congressional district. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Stay with us. Coming up, Julia Child's great-nephew on how she became an American TV icon. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.